This is the Lean Construction Blogs podcast, a podcast dedicated to stories, case studies, and lessons learned of applying lean construction from around the world. Join Dick Beyer as he interviews industry leaders, lean construction practitioners, and subject matter experts to help you improve the built environment in general and your design and construction projects in particular. Advance your lean journey and bring your continuous improvement efforts to the next level. Let's get started.
Good morning, everybody. I am Dick Beyer. This is the podcast, and this is episode 26. So we have gone past the quarter century mark, and I am pleased that not only did we pass the quarter century mark, but I have a Mark to join us today. And I'm actually thrilled to have Mark Van Buren join us on the podcast today. He is the grand poobah of delivery of all things buildings and built environment for the city of Kingston. And he joins us from his home in Kingston. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, good morning, Dick. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you. How are you today?
Doing awesome. It's a wonderful day here in Kingston. We're finally getting some sun shining and some nice warm weather. So yeah, no, life is good.
You know, it's amazing how the frozen north in 2 weeks transforms into the arboreal Garden of Eden. It's amazing to me.
Absolutely. And we get this nice little weather window where, you know, the everything starts to get green and we get some nice temperatures. And then all of a sudden we'll get the midges and the mosquitoes that'll start to descend on us. So
We're pretty lucky here in Ottawa. It's not as bad as it
Well, good. I'm gonna have to spend more time in Ottawa then.
Yeah, come on north, my friend.
All right.
So let's start with a little background. You know, where you came from. First let's start with your exact title. Your title is one of those guys that has lots of scrambled eggs on his epaulets and hard to describe all the different things that go into your title, but you're the high commissioner of something, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to keep track of all those titles. I'm just the guy, you know, but I'm the deputy commissioner for the city of Kingston. And yeah, I've been involved with our major projects group for probably the better part of the last, six years now.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And then before that, it was kind of a variety of different roles at the city. Started there probably a little over 21 years ago now. So amazing. How quickly time goes.
Are you from Kingston originally?
So no, actually, I was born in Calgary. So out in the Western provinces. My father was working in the oil patch back in the day, and that was after he had emigrated from Holland when he was just a young guy, kind of post-World War II, and probably same with an awful lot of Dutch people moving over to Canada in those years, and he settled, out in Western Canada and working in the oil fields. And so, yeah, that's where I was born. And then after that, he decided to move the family back east and started a long career with Ontario Hydro that eventually, as probably many listeners might know, kind of morphed into Hydro One, which was responsible for transmission of electricity and Ontario Power Generation, which was kind of the generation side of the company. So basically, anywhere that they were building a nuclear power plant in Ontario, we lived for periods of time.
Oh, so that's where you get all your energy from, fossil fuel, from electricity, hydropower, nuclear. No wonder you're
full of energy.
Charges out there, yeah. Yeah, being born out west is a good thing. I'm a Denver boy myself, and there's something kind of independent and entrepreneurial and respect for nature, I think, comes out of being born out west. So you ended up, as you moved around with your dad and all the isotopes and your family, you ended up at Queen's University, correct?
Yeah. So my brother, who's a couple of years older than I am, he decided that Queen's University in Kingston was going to be the place that he was going to start his post-secondary life. And in fact, we, as a family, we had spent a couple of summers vacationing in Kingston. And, beautiful city, located right on the North Shore of Lake Ontario, just as it's narrowing into the St. Lawrence River. And, particularly in the summer, an awful lot of water sports here. And him and I had kind of both had an interest in windsurfing back in the day. And Kingston was probably one of the best places in the province for people that had an interest in windsurfing. It kind of always some great winds that would funnel into this part of the lake. So that was, hate to say it, but that was actually part of the whole package of deciding to come to Queens was, hey, maybe we could spend some time sailing in the city.
Yeah, what a good idea. Yeah. For our international visitors that don't know about Kingston, it's across Lake Ontario from the U.S. and was meant to be the capital of Canada until the army discovered that there could be artillery shells lofted across the lake in its direction, and it seemed a little more dangerous than a place like Ottawa that was way upriver.
Yeah, put Ottawa there on the map finally. But we still celebrate our position as the first capital of the country.
It's one of the most historic towns in Canada. It's really beautiful. I just loved my time down there. Mm-hmm. So you ended up going to Queens, and of course you wanted to be an artist, and like the picture behind you, but that's not where you ended up, eh?
No, in fact, my journey at Queens started in life sciences. So I guess back in the day, I had this crazy idea that maybe a career in medicine might suit me well. And then came along a course called organic chemistry that set me straight. So
told that in order to be an architect, I had to take organic chemistry, and I was taking organic chemistry in high school. And after blowing up my notebook and causing the fire department to show up, inventing the magic eraser, I was negotiated out of organic chemistry.
So that's when you have to pivot quickly. And so at that point in time, I, probably some soul searching there at the young age of 19. And, what was it that I really enjoyed? And, when I reflected back at that point in time, it was an awful lot around construction. And architecture was actually central to kind of my upbringing, my father kind of, in the business, very much, around construction projects all the time. Even when it was back at home, my father always enjoyed, either building homes or doing significant renovations. So, it was kind of in the blood. And yeah. So that started me down a path of civil engineering. And I graduated in the early 90s with a degree in civil engineering. And at that point in time, we were in a real deep recession here in Canada. I don't know if people remember that. And I remember my graduating class. I think there was probably 35 of us that graduated, and all but two, we didn't have jobs. Yeah. So that meant an awful lot of us were sticking around and heading to grad school. And actually, in some weird way, it worked out nicely. At that point in time, even though I was very much focused on, more structural engineering, steel, I got introduced actually to some people that were more involved in the world of hydrology and hydraulics. And actually had a summer student job working at the local conservation authority where, they were involved in doing flood forecasting. And so that kind of drove me down a direction of developing a specialty in hydrology, more particularly stormwater management. And so my grad work was focused in that area. to the point where I actually stuck around and did a PhD, where I was looking particularly at contaminants typically found in urban runoff, looking at the thermal enhancement of stormwater runoff in urban areas and what sort of downstream implications that could have in kind of natural environments. So yeah, that was kind of my post-secondary, well, I should say my graduate work was focused more in kind of hydrology and hydraulics.
Interesting. And you were, and all of that work was done at Queen's, right?
All done at Queen's. And then it was a time thereafter where it's like, hey, you know, I got to see the world outside of Kingston. So I hopped on a plane, headed to Oakland, and had a job interview and a job offer with a company called CH2M Hill. I think they have since kind of joined forces, become Jacobs Engineering. Right. And, you know, so they said, well, why don't you take a look at our San Jose office? And you know, we got lots of work down there, you know, for guys like you with your specialty. And, you know, love the whole area. I mean, San Francisco, the whole Bay Area, just beautiful. But quickly realized that that salary and the cost of living down there wasn't going to equal. So I decided to move to a place that maybe was a little bit more affordable. So I landed in Milwaukee. And spent about 3 years working in Milwaukee and kind of, you know, shuttling back and forth between Milwaukee and Chicago, working on some pretty interesting, water resources related projects there.
Wow, fantastic. And so what Milwaukee has in common with Kingston is it's hard to breast one of the Great Lakes. It has that same kind of, it's interesting that you've, and most of your work has kind of gravitated around, you know, being near water, whether it's, you know, sailing or working or purifying things. It's fantastic. So when did you get back to Kingston?
So I got again, life was going really well there in Milwaukee, and, you know, an awful lot of work. Milwaukee, a great, great small city. But you know, they had their issues there with lots of, they were built on a combined sewage system. So, you know, an awful lot of investment to try to deal with some of the implications, around that, an awful lot of urban flooding, you know, it was an awful lot of infill into floodplain areas. So, you know, big projects to try to deal with flood control within the city of Milwaukee. You know, so that was late 90s. And then came along 9/11. In fact, I remember the day well. It was kind of one of those regular road trips from Milwaukee to Chicago, and you know, listen to the news along the highway there. And my gosh, it was a day I'll never forget. Watching all the planes lining up. I mean, for some reason or other, I think they were diverting them from Chicago O'Hare up to Milwaukee. And so thereafter, it really made travel, you know, particularly tough. You know, heading back home to Kingston and doing the cross-border stuff became very, very difficult. So that was kind of the impetus to try to, you know, move operations back to Canada.
Cool. Yeah. I remember that day, my time. I think every person who listens to this broadcast that was, you know, 10 years older will certainly remember where they were and what happened. And it was one of those days that I remember I was on a train going up to my little oil company. So I shared that in common with your father. I owned a little Manly Oil in Los Angeles. I was heading up there from San Diego, and I called my son, who was back at Villanova, who had several friends whose fathers worked on Wall Street. Well, you know, they were all very worried. And I said, you know, this is one of those days that after which nothing will ever be the same. And that was true. And those early days of trying to get on a plane after, you know, once they finally reopened the airports, it was terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and again, it was at that point in time in my career, frequent travel, and yeah, it was tough. I mean, you remember just the, you know, planning for lots of time. Every time you're in an airport, it was significant. And then, even though, obviously Canada, U.S. have great relations, and I was working on a trade NAFTA visa. I think they've now changed NAFTA to some other acronym, but nevertheless, there was always, kind of the Q&A that had happened at a border crossing. Just made travel more difficult. And at that point in time, it was an opportunity for me to kind of rekindle a relationship that I had back in my school days. And, happy news, we're since married and produced two great kids that are moving their way through life. So,
wow.
Yeah. So,
the life journey went well. Those reckless days in the States of wild demand and came home to roost with a nice little family in Kingston.
That's right.
So how did you, did you come back and work for the city immediately or?
Yeah, well, actually, no, when I moved back, I was still with Parsons, based in the States. And that was kind of, again, that travel back and forth that was getting, pretty tiring. And then there was an opportunity. One of my colleagues actually that I had gone to school with at Queens, he had kind of a senior leadership position at the city of Kingston, and I got talking to him, and he said, "Hey, Mark, we're interested in having guys like you join forces here. Lots of opportunities in kind of that water resources side of the business." So. That started me at the city of Kingston, and then probably a couple of years into my career there at the city, I was offered the chance to take on the entire engineering group. So, the engineering group obviously involved in an awful lot of different aspects of municipal infrastructure, right? You're now progressing out of just strictly water resources, you're getting into transportation, you're getting into facilities, you're getting into basically everything that makes cities tick. And so that was kind of a chance to kind of, again, maybe broaden some of my experience in the municipal business. And at that point in time, Kingston was kind of going through a significant growth phase. So, significant investments in infrastructure in the city. And an awful lot of those were kind of transportation related, building new roads, new bridges, significant redevelopment of our downtown core. You being in Kingston, downtown Kingston very dominated by tourism through the summer months.
Yeah, and rightfully so. It's a beautiful place to visit.
Yeah, but at the same time, having downtown merchants and vendors that they don't want to disrupt that. But at the same time, you're trying to build and renew municipal infrastructure. That was an awful lot of work to try to plan how you could basically rip up every single street in our downtown core and rebuild it.
Yeah,
and keep businesses flourishing at the same time.
Well, it's funny, the guy who's running the TTC renovations of the subway or expansions in Toronto, when he got pushback about closing all these streets for 5 or 6 years, said, "Well, it's just kind of inconvenient."
Yeah.
An understatement. So really, your whole career, this is really interesting, because I didn't know this about you. Your entire career has been focused on doing really large infrastructure projects.
Yeah.
Civil engineering projects, moving a lot of dirt, digging a lot of holes, channeling a lot of water.
And working with an awful lot of design consultants and contractors. And, and invariably an awful lot of those experiences, in my mind, Dick, they always seem to go the same way. Relationships that, were always singular in nature. Spend a boatload of time working with your design consultants and cobble together a bunch of drawings and contract specifications, and then they're out the door, and then it was time spent with a contractor trying to get all that stuff in the ground.
Not always happy, right?
never happy, to be honest with you, Dick. I always used to say that, you know, the best day of any construction project was maybe the day that we had the kickoff meeting. And every day thereafter seemed to just be a steady march southwards, and, you know, relationships that would fray. And I don't think I can really reflect back on too many projects that I would say, yeah, you know, that was a good experience. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, the infrastructure would get built and get put in the ground and functional. But on the personal side of it, I would never really reflect back on those and say, hey, that was a great, joyful experience. And to the point that, you know, it had me second guessing what I wanted to do. I said to myself, you know, there's either got to be a better, different way, or I got to find something else to do.
Right. So obviously you were part of these big teams. Were you part of the teams that selected the contract vehicle or selected the procurement process? Or, because I mean, I'm assuming that a lot of your work, if not the entirety of your work, has been in the public sector.
Yeah, Dick. And I mean, the absolute dominance of all of these projects were being delivered as design bid built. And so, yes, you know, very much involved in the selection of the consultants. And then, you know, it would be the regular development of a tender put out for procurement through, you know, a low bid. And that's the way our industry worked, at least in Kingston, for a number of years. So, you know, that was the defining feature. The turning point was actually when we got involved in kind of the revitalization of our downtown core. At that point in time, you know, there was a realization, as we just talked about, that, you know, look, there were so many other influences that, you know, needed to be taken into consideration in these projects that, you know, you couldn't just unleash a contractor in a downtown area, start closing streets and digging up pipes, and having all the implications that would come along with that, where you're trying to keep, you know, businesses, you know, moving along. So that was the first time that we actually had introduced an RFP to hire a consultant or contractor, sorry. And that sent the local construction industry kind of into a tizzy. They had been so accustomed to just filling out a bid form. And, you know, now we were actually asking them to write, you know, describe your approach. How are you going to manage some of these things? How are you going to do, engagement with some of the downtown merchants? How are you going to manage communications? What's your approach for winter construction? And having contractors actually being involved in actually trying to describe their work, you know, that was a significant change, at least here in kind of the Eastern Ontario area. They were so accustomed to just, well, I'll put my price there and understanding that at the end of the day, it was going to be the low price. So it was going to be the guy that was going to take the work.
Right. Interesting. So that's an interesting pivot, that actually you would ask people to explain what it is they were going to do. And how did that work? What was that? You said there was some pushback from the contracting side of things. There are specialty contractors that do roads and bridges and civil infrastructure. And it doesn't include everybody. You know, it's not your residential contractors or your small guys. So most of the companies you were dealing with, I'm assuming, were pretty large.
Really, they were big for Eastern Ontario. But again, like I said, I use the idea that it was like, you know, you're moving somebody's cheese. How dare you? You know, we're so accustomed. This is the way our companies are tooled up, that, you know, we're so accustomed to filling out the bid form. And that's how we approach our work here. So, you know, now all of a sudden you're having a contractor probably having to you know, staff differently, you know, in responding to an RFP. The other side that was equally as difficult was the conversations that we would have even with our public and our city council. You know, that so when we were awarding projects to companies that were not the low bid, so we had to go through the whole discussion of value versus price. And then I can remember those years where, you know, that was difficult. You know, in the media, you know, they certainly focused an awful lot on those discussions back in the day. Where, you know, people just thought every contractor was cut equally. So why wouldn't we be taking the person that was giving us the lowest price? And if you weren't, that was a misutilization of taxpayer dollars. And so,
which is a felony in some places,
right? So it's tough to try to continually, you know, put across the idea of value, you know, and right. Have people understand what does value mean. And those discussions took some time before we finally kind of got a breakthrough where, you know, you were actually able to get people to understand. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I do want the value here. I do now understand that, you know, low bid is not necessarily going to equal best outcome.
Right. So it's in my little world, all of the things that you're talking about is include the lack of transparency in the original, you know, process, the thinking about the value and the performance-based contracting, the thinking about kind of chaos theory, because, you know, chaos theory is basically that when things get complex, not just complicated, a lot of stuff we do is complicated and we get it figured out, but when things become complex, they want to move to the lowest level of organization, which is chaos, right? Because each piece wants to spin off on its own and just do its own little thing. And so how did you build up, some owners are concerned that if they change the game from what's being offered in the marketplace by the contractors, that they won't get any bids, that people will stay away from it. And it's happened in a couple of instances. So how did you try to deal with that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Dick. And that did play in the back of my mind and the back of the mind of others was that, yeah, if you try to move too quickly, too radically, I mean, do people just, you know, steer around you? I think, you know, we were fortunate. I don't think we let that kind of risk, you know, seep into us to a great extent. I think, you know, myself and some others at the city, I think, you know, we got to the point in time where it was like, you know, how much longer are we going to continue to think that we can just push risk away from ourselves, you know, that we can kind of commoditize it and just sell it off to somebody else to take it. And I think we kind of turned that whole thing around and we said, well, look, you know, instead of trying to push risk away, why don't we just accept the fact that risk exists on all of these projects? And why don't we try to find the best way to deal with that? And, you know, that was probably our tip into the whole world of integrated project delivery was, yeah, you know, just the core idea of, you know, shared risk and shared reward. And, you know, I keep thinking about that almost every other day is just that simple saying, you know, shared risk, shared reward. And it just grabbed me. You know, to think that, you know, it's so simple, but so true.
Well, and I think we had a conversation a couple of years ago, and you said, you know, frankly, at the city of Kingston, we are not risk averse. We understand risk pretty well, and we embrace the opportunity to manage it and not sell it to somebody, which I think was key to what you were trying to do as you moved into IPD.
And the other thing that was a realization for me as well was that, you know, an awful lot of these large infrastructure projects, you know, they have a fair bit of history, you know, associated with them, even to get them to the point where they're ready for, you know, the design build phase. You know, we'll talk about it, but, you know, the large bridge project, the third crossing, Wabin Crossing here in Kingston, that, you know, was delivered through an IPD. You know, here's a project that had been in the Kingston community talked about for almost 50 years. You know, and then bits and spurts of work and, you know, assessment and analysis on that bridge crossing that, you know, you have a body of knowledge and experience that the owner has kind of accumulated on these projects, you know, over years. And right. So, you know, this, you know, the integrated project delivery model is an opportunity that allows for the owner to kind of unleash all of that knowledge into the project team instead of trying to, you know, condense all of that stuff into an RFP document, or even worse, into a bid form, where a consultant or a contractor get maybe a couple of months to analyze the information and come back and give you a price.
Yeah, exactly. So tell us this bridge project, which I think is the, you know, the star in your constellation. Unless you've done one since then, I don't know about. But, you know, there's a new book by Brent Flyberg, who's one of my go-to guys, because he has the iron law of mega projects, and he's looked at 16,000 mega projects, and has come to the conclusion that the iron law of mega projects is over time, over budget, under benefit, over and over again. And you would fall into the classification of his. So he says 47% of projects are over budget all the time, that only 8% of projects are basically on budget and on time, and only 0.5%, a half a percent of projects are actually on time, on budget, and provide the benefits that you had hoped for. And I think you fall right into that 0.5%. I'm sure people are interested in how'd you get there?
Yeah.
So maybe some background on the bridge. Because I think that the story of how many people were involved between First Nations and parks and all the provincial financing and the federal financing, it was a complicated project.
Yeah. I'd say quite complicated. In fact, you know, as we talked about, there are, you know, 50 years in the making, but probably 12 years of kind of concentrated effort. And that's when I got involved, was back in 2008. It was our chief administrative officer at the time said, I remember being with him in a car ride, and he said, "Hey, Mark, I need to get you involved in a project here. It's big, but, you know, I'd like to get you to manage it." Probably never really knew what I was getting into at the time, but I said, "Sure.
No problem.
Yeah, problem. Let's go. Why don't you show me where this is?"
Right.
So, that was 2008. And, the years that kind of followed after that were, you know, going through kind of the typical phases of a large infrastructure project. This bridge is, it's about 1.2 kilometers. So, you know, pretty close to, I guess, 3/4 of a mile in length. And singularly the biggest infrastructure project we've ever done in the city of Kingston. So we've got a budget of $180 million to build this, and funded, you know, in equal thirds by the city of Kingston, the government of Ontario, and the government of Canada. And, you know, the backdrop of this project was pretty divided. I mean, we had, you know, part of the Kingston community that, you know, really saw this as an opportunity to kind of see continued growth and development within our community. The other part of the community, very, very vocally against the project, saw this as just the opportunity for more urban sprawl and utilization of city financial resources in an area that would be better utilized in other spots. So that made it a very difficult kind of political environment to navigate within. And also, draped over top of all of that, we're in a class one wetland environment, and we're also in a UNESCO World Heritage Zone. So we had all the makings of complexity here. We had a very heavy indigenous influence, particularly with the Mohawk community. So yeah, it was you had to navigate carefully to make sure that this project could keep moving forward.
So only one of the challenging decisions you had to make was what procurement model you were going to do it on. So tell us how you segued into that from this experience of doing RFPs and getting the city, especially the city mothers and fathers, focused on value as the highest component.
Yeah. Well, one of the significant things we did in the journey was actually put together a business plan for the project. Really helpful in a number of different ways. The component pieces of the business plan, it looked at doing a cost-benefit analysis for the bridge. So we were comparing it with other large bridges across North America and trying to understand what sort of a benefit we could derive from the bridge in relation to other projects of this nature. It actually showed that this one was going to be very favorable. We did an economic impact analysis where, if you spend $180 million in the local community, what sort of spin-off benefits can you expect locally and regionally? And the last piece was a procurement options analysis. So that's where we were trying to look at, okay, let's do some side-by-side comparisons here. Let's look at design bid build. We actually even explored public-private partnership. And then the last one that we threw in kind of at the last minute was alliancing or IPD. We spent a fair bit of time with Infrastructure Ontario doing a value for money analysis on a 3P. So that, in that case, it was a design build finance. And we went through all of that, Dick, and you're doing kind of the typical risk analysis. I don't know, things just didn't necessarily add up in my mind that that was going to deliver the best value for us.
I think P3 has panned out to be just a very expensive way of financing infrastructure that doesn't bring the bang for the buck that you thought it was and brings some of the very traditional delivery problems that you have, because it doesn't create the partnership that you're really looking for.
The design bid build, I think we pretty much scratched that off the list instantaneously, because about 2 years before that we were doing a smaller bridge through a DBB and ended up having to fire the contractor just over the fact that, we had a dispute on even dewatering something as simple as a dewatering plan for a bridge abutment. So not wanting to tempt that fate again, the design bid build option was kind of off the table quickly. And then as I mentioned earlier, IPD, this idea that, hey, we could set up an environment here where we could have shared risk, shared reward. We had a good core team at the city that had an awful lot of knowledge and experience on the project that we had accumulated. And hey, like this IPD, look, we can actually roll up our sleeves and we can be involved, set up a big room, working shoulder to shoulder with the design consultant and the contractor. That makes sense. And there was a willingness, on the city side to actually dedicate that time to the project, instead of, again, trying to find a way in which we could just, move that risk away from ourselves and leave it to the design build team.
How much did How much did you have to socialize that with the people that you worked for? I mean, you were pretty high in the chain because you are the director of engineering and the, you know, the high commissioner and all the rest of that.
Dick, to be honest with you, it was very little. The procurement options analysis section of our business plan, you know, was you know, pretty thick, but you know, the amount that we had devoted to IPD was pretty thin. I think we said everything we wanted to about IPD in maybe two pages. And very little discussion about that either in public meetings that we did where we were sharing kind of the results, or even with our city council. I think there was kind of that trust level that was granted to us to say, okay, look, you know, you guys, you're the professionals. We're going to put the trust in you guys to deliver this project in the best way you see fit. We also, you know, we had procurement procedures in the bylaw in place that enabled this as well too. So we weren't necessarily restricted in that manner, in which we only had a few tools in the toolbox that we could pick from.
Great. So, and you had an ally in the city attorney who began to kind of believe in the, you know, this isn't completely crazy, Mark. This might actually work pretty well.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, Alan well, and yeah, Alan was very much, you know, one of those instrumental people at the city that said, hey, you know, let's look at this, and, you know, brought it back to us, and, you know, we looked at it, and then we got introduced to you. I remember meeting you up in Ottawa there for the first time. And yeah, Dick, I mean, you were a huge part of our journey, you know, giving us that confidence, helping us learn more about the intricacies of the model. You know, as we were bringing more people into our city project team, you know, you were there to help with kind of that coaching and mentoring. And yeah, no, it was huge. Can't thank you enough for that. You had kind of that confidence that you kind of instilled into us. Hey guys, you know, get ready. You can walk down this path and you can do well.
What I was really intrigued by was that, you know, I was not aware of a bridge that had been built with IPD. And I thought it's not only practically perfect, but it's metaphorically perfect in terms of building bridges and, you know, connecting people and thoughts and different things. So this is my favorite project in the entire world, except for yours out there, if I'm working with you. But this was such a joy for me because you put together the right team, and you guys didn't balk at owner involvement. I mean, you welcomed it. It's almost like you relished participating in this.
Yeah, well, I remember you touring us around a big room facility up there in Ottawa, and you know, we got a chance to see, you know, how you could set up a big room. And you know, I think we were even there during one of the days where, you know, there was a big room, you know, working away. And even the environment, you know, was enticing, you know, walking in there and seeing people, you know, in an open space with rolling whiteboards and, you know, cluster groups, you know, working away and exchanging ideas. And just the environment alone, you know, was compelling that you wanted to be involved in that. I don't know how we got ourselves into a working world in which we shoved ourselves into, you know, walls and doors, right. and we communicate with people through texts and emails when, you know, here's an environment where you could actually, you know, you're right there. Nothing wrong with talking to somebody, you know, right in front of you instead of having to write a report and wait 3 weeks before they review it and get your comments back.
It was pretty funny. We would call people on that because they would be sitting next to each other in an open office and texting each other when they were right there. It was pretty funny. So you embraced the IPD process really fully. And I think that was one of the great things that your experience with value for money obviously had given you kind of a leg up on how important the team was and how important the approach was. And unlike most owners who don't have, who perceive that they don't have time to do the really deep dive into the interview process and the RFP process, you guys were a shining example of take the time to really understand what these people are bringing to the table, so that it's not a bait and switch. It's not a, oh yeah, we know all about this, and then they don't. It was the best interview process I think I've been a part of. So tell us how you got there.
Yeah, well, we were about 8 months through that entire part of the journey, from issuing the RFP for an IPD team to doing team selection. So, that was a meaningful amount of time, but, I reflect back on it and I think, thank goodness we did, because as you said, I mean, what an absolutely crucial part of the whole journey is to make sure you got to get that best team. And, I think one of the things that we did after we ended up having 8 submissions on our original RFP, and then we did a shortlist to 3. And then after we shortlisted to 3, that's where things really got intense. So we had a whole series of confidential commercial meetings with each of those teams. And Dick, you'll remember you were actually there with us to watch as we were putting these teams through their paces, as we gave them kind of a live pull plan exercise and watched the ones that did well versus the ones that.
Yeah, it was funny. We had to leave the room and I was thinking, oh God, here we go.
Yeah.
But it taught us a
lot, didn't it? It taught us a lot.
And it worked out, I think. So, I mean, obviously the proof is in the pudding. But I think the project team that you had, it's now, evangelical about delivering in IPD ways and that collaborative process.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, they were as excited, I think, as we were to be part of kind of a first journey. Doing an IPD on a large, infrastructure project, transportation infrastructure project. But again, as you had always coached us, the idea that every project is going to have its moments of misery. You call it the peak of despair. I call it the valley of despair. One way or another, it was despair. And we had our moments where, the project was in really tough shape as we were trying to navigate through some real tough things, mostly around how we were going to get, how we were going to approach building the bridge.
Right.
Were we going to float all of our operations out in the river in order to build the bridge? We were going to try to dredge in order to get enough water depth so that we could get in there with a floating operation. Would we have to build a temporary work bridge? Or could we get away with building a temporary causeway? And these decisions had like tens of millions of dollars of implications associated with them.
Right.
And so, I always tell people is that there is no way that any one party to the team could have been able to figure things out and make things happen in a successful way. I look back on it and I'm absolutely 100% convinced that it required the owner, it required the designer, it required the contractor to really come up with the idea, pitch it, sell it, get the approvals in place. And those were, turning moments for the project. That, if it didn't happen that way, I'm not so sure we'd actually have a bridge standing today. We certainly wouldn't have had a bridge standing today that was delivered on time and on budget.
I think that's the phenomenal history of this bridge, is that building anything is not trivial, right? It is not kumbaya. Everybody gets in a boat and it happens overnight all by itself, and people are you know, doing jello shooters or whatever. It's a difficult thing in building in the environment that you were building in, because it wasn't just, oh, well, just go out in the river and do whatever you want to, because you were in a very sensitive part of the river. You had Parks Canada looking, you know, over your shoulder, plus the public looking over your shoulder at every turn. And you had tough decisions that you had to make about things that, you know, you were trying new things and trying new things. And procurement's one thing, trying new things and how bridges come together is another thing.
Well, you know, and it's during those times too, where, you know, that's where you're testing. You're testing the idea of IPD at its core. That, you know, when things get to be at a point of despair, you know, I think we saw the tendency of people trying to revert back to traditional. You know, well, how do I protect, you know, myself and my corporate interests? And that's where we really had to double down. To remind people that, nope, you know, this is shared risk and shared reward. We're in this together. You know, I even had my struggles within my own city of Kingston to remind people that, hey, you know, this was not being, you know, delivered in a traditional format. No, this, we had made a commitment to delivering this project in IPD. Now is the time to really show that leadership that, this is, we are a team. We're sharing this risk all the way to the end. And it was great, you know, that, you know, you get people sitting together and you get people working through problems, and eventually the solutions will show themselves.
Is there a time that you remember that, you know, like a big epiphany, a big turning point where suddenly the team really gelled and you turned a corner and it wasn't, you know, smooth sailing from there, but everybody was aligned through the squalls and the storms and the clear days and the doldrums, all the rest of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember the day. In fact, it was the main span for the bridge. You know, the way we had originally envisioned it, it was going to be an overarch design, and it was going to have a span length of about 120 meters. I don't know how you convert that to feet, but significant. Right. And you know, and at that point in time, you know, we were looking at that and, you know, starting to price that out as a team and realizing, holy smokes, that's an expensive part, an expensive operation, expensive to build, difficult part of the river to get that piece in. And again, you know, we're working as a team there, and you know, remember it was Kiewit. It was guys from the contracting side that said, hey, you know, why don't we rethink this thing? Why do we need to go 120 meters? And why do we need an overarch? What if we went with an underarch design? And I remember we were even sketching this stuff out on literally on a napkin in a bar. You know, coming up with the idea of going with an underarch as opposed to an overarch and narrowing the whole thing up. And then it was like, well, hey, you know, the primary stakeholder here is going to be the rowing club, because, you know, they wanted to have the dimensions that would fit X number of rowing lanes underneath the main span. Well, then you figured out that they didn't really need all of those rowing lanes. They just needed a couple of them to act as return lanes to go back up to the top end of the course. So, you know, we were actually able to reduce that down to a 90-meter span with an underarch design. And, you know, lo and behold, we're $30 million savings. And these are powerful moments as a team, right? When you get that, you know, those type of success moments, you know, those are things and times where you're gelling as a team.
Well, and this is what you don't get when you do design, bid, build, because the contractor has to build that design. And having the contractor at the table designing is almost as important as having the designers at the table thinking about means and methods. And we isolate these things in our industry for some crazy reason. I have no idea why we... I have a pretty good idea. It's the lawyers and being... part of that cult, you know, guilty. But it just doesn't make sense to break everything into a piece and assign brain responsibility for only one little tiny bit of it when, you know, just as you have shown there. I mean, that's really innovation. You're flipping the problem on its head, literally, is what you guys did.
Well, and again, you know, solutions coming up from areas that you wouldn't necessarily expect. I mean, in a traditional sense, you'd be thinking it'd be your design consultant that would be figuring out, you know, these general arrangements for a bridge.
Right.
But, you know, to have a contractor looking at it and saying, look, you know, constructability is going to be an enormous part of trying to figure out how we can do this. You know, let's have the constructability piece have a strong influence on the design aspects. You know, and that's the type of environment, you know, that I think IPD unlocks, right, is this idea that, you know, nobody wears kind of their corporate hat. You know, they just come in with a team hat on. You know, maybe one day you're skating defense and the next day you're a forward. I mean, and what's wrong with
right.
that?
Right. Yeah, I was describing it the other day that, in fact, what we try to do is not be the goalie. We try not to sit back and wait for the problems to come to us. We're trying to rush up ice, right. You know, which is exactly why the Leafs lost that last game, because guess what? The Panthers were right there with them.
Yeah.
Active defense at the front, man. Unbelievable.
And, you know, I think that type of a work environment, again, it's exciting for people. You know, we talked about it as well, particularly for the young people.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about some of the people that are, you know, they're new into their careers. I think these are very, very much more exciting work environments to be part of. You know, the traditional approach where, you know, I hate to say it, you know, you're lined up at the boardroom table and half of the people sitting there are lawyers trying to figure out whether or not they're actually going to accept a change order. I mean, it's not necessarily a compelling work environment for young people. So,
uh-huh.
You know, it's going to be an important part, right? Is be able to engage, you know, people that really want to be involved in these types of large projects and do it in a great way, a fun way.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, doing great projects, the intrinsic motivation of a job well done is, can't be understated, but I think you also had other innovations. I know when I was sitting with your team, you had the chief communicator from the city, and your commitment was to transparency, that you were going to let, you know, unlike the O-Train in Ottawa, where the oversight committee that was investigating that disaster said that the mayor and the city manager had actually lied to the people of Ottawa. That wasn't your gig.
Yeah, no, again, you know, one of the hallmarks of IPD is, you know, openness and transparency. I mean, if you're going to commit to that, you're going to commit to it. So, that was alive and well in our big room, but, you know, even outward facing to the public, you know, it was the way in which we wanted to approach the project. You know,
I think it was really successful. I mean, you had your website and you had, you know, your chief communications officer updating people in real time all the time.
Yeah. And then, you know, even some community Facebook groups were showing up that were, you know, doing drone imagery and flyovers. And I remember, you know, the early days of that was kind of tense. You know, again, you think back to traditional things. Well, you know, what's the person there with the camera taking pictures of me? I mean, they must be spying on me. I must be doing something wrong. And and then, you know, over time, you know, that becomes commonplace. And then, you know, these people are starting to figure out, hey, maybe there truly is a level of interest in what I'm doing, you know. And we saw that, Dick, was, you know, an awful lot of these, you know, the labor part of actually building a bridge. You know, you had people that were, you know, steel rebar and forming concrete and erecting steel. I mean, why don't we do more to celebrate the nature of that work and we let the public see it? And then you could actually start to see the pride that was coming into these people that, you know, they actually enjoyed seeing themselves on a Facebook or a YouTube video where they're actually profiling some of the great work that they were doing. And this all happening during the time of COVID as well, which was doubly impactful, right? That, you know, here were people that, you know, arguably, I guess they could have easily just stayed home because of all of the fear that was out in the world at this point in time. But our project was deemed to be an essential project and the work kept going. And so it was great to profile these people in such a positive way. And I think we as the owner understood that we had an enormous part to make sure that we could facilitate that. So myself, many of the other, you know, members of the team are out there religiously just thanking people, you know, showing an interest in the type of work that they're doing, right?
Yeah.
Constantly trying to build that team environment where, you know, what they were doing was equally as important as what was happening back in the big room.
Well, we are always servants to the people who actually do the work, I think, you know, and I think we need to remember our job is not to manage them. Our job is to support their efforts and make sure that nothing stands in their way of being successful at their work. And it's a hard thing to think about. But you also had some other successful partners. I know Walter Steele was your steel partner, and you could have run into some real challenges in supply chain. And I know the Walters people well, and they loved being on the Kingston Bridge.
Yeah. So our multi-party agreement was, you know, City, Kiewit as the contractor and Hatch as the design consultant. But yeah, we brought on two major trade partners. So they participated in the profit pool, and that was Bauer Foundations. So they were responsible. A huge risk part of the whole project was getting these deep in water foundations. You know, in some cases, we're about 150 feet deep to anchor ourselves into bedrock. And then, yeah, Walter Steele, who were responsible for kind of that main span. That's where we, you know, we generate the highest point in the entire bridge and kind of the signature part of the entire bridge. So, yeah, you know, and their involvement, particularly in that point in time where we had some of the steel tariffs that were going on, you know, pretty critical to make sure that we could get that dialed all in with prices of steel that were fluctuating so much in the market at that point in time in our journey.
Yeah, and even having steel available was, you know, an issue.
Absolutely.
So, well, it was a very cool project. And now, have you driven across the bridge, actually?
I've been across it a few times, yeah.
I thought you might be a little nervous. You know, things went so well, and, you know, driving across the bridge, I hope it doesn't, like, you know, pop on me or something, right?
Well, we got this great multi-use path that's on the bridge as well. So, like, 4 meter wide, just dedicated for cyclists and pedestrians. But I want to strap on my rollerblades and make my first trip across on that multi-use path.
There you go. Yeah. So what's next for you? I mean, it's hard to build a bridge like that and then go back to building, you know, a little power station for a fire. Yeah. Station someplace in town.
No, you know, you're right, Dick. I'm hooked on this IPD stuff. I'm reinvigorated. Like I said, it's fun to be part of a project where, you know, you feel that creativity, you know, day in, day out, and, you know, you're working with like-minded people. And again, I think IPD, I haven't found anything better that kind of allows for those things to come together.
And you have a variety of projects. What would you say to owners that say, well, IPD is good for, you know, a $200 million project, but, you know, I've got a $30 million swimming pool or a $50 million elementary school. That's just too small for an IPD.
I don't buy it. I think there's probably a dollar threshold, you know, getting yourself probably somewhere over 10 million. But more importantly is that there probably has to have some level of complexity associated with it. You know, we've got neighbors here next to our community that, yeah, they're interested in a large rec facility with a 50-meter pool. They're using IPD. You know, last week, speaking to a procurement group in Ontario, 250, you know, purchasing agents across the province that, you know, they just have an interest in what's this IPD thing all about. So we are starting to see this explosion of interest, with municipalities, not just in Ontario, but across the provinces. They want to know more. They've got a large interest in this stuff. City of Kitchener, they're kind of, again, IPD for a large rec facility. Again, I think they got a 50-meter pool that's going in as part of that. $80 million project that, they're intent on delivering through IPD. For me personally, I really think that there is an enormous opportunity in the linear infrastructure space. We'll know that IPD, had its foundations more in the vertical world facilities, but I see huge opportunities in transportation and horizontal infrastructure projects to use IPD. And so, yes, part of my mission is being out there, and people that are interested, they want to know more, come talk to me.
Yeah, you've been so open and participatory about that I agree with you. I mean, I don't understand why we wouldn't be doing every infrastructure project as complex and difficult as they can be. Why wouldn't we be trying to put our best minds towards risk mitigation and dealing with the inevitable issues that you're going to have? I mean, I read the report on the O-Train in Ottawa, and a large part of the problem was the adversarial relationship between all of the parties, and this idea that I'm gonna beat up on you. And it's naturally part of bilateral contracts, because in a two-party contract there's a winner and a loser every single time. It might be marginal, but they're not calculated to create relationships like the IPD relational contract, which has everybody has to, I think to make it work, like you said, it has to be shared risk and reward, but it really has to be that people have to sink or swim together. They have to understand that their accountability is not only to their firm but to their team.
Well, and I think, the good news is that we're seeing more of it now, Dick. And, even in Toronto, huge project there with the revitalization, rebuilding of Union Station, largest, most important train station in the entire country, operated through Metrolinx. And that's being delivered through an alliance model, as a little bit of a cousin to IPD, but still, these idea of these collaborative contract models, I think, we are seeing much more, movement into that space than I think we ever have.
Yeah, especially in as you say, in the collaborative area, progressive design build, even CM at risk, we're trying to get teams together to think about cost and schedule and constructability early on. So we have much more information before, even if you have to freeze somebody at, okay, so I'm going to give you another $4 million to take on the risk of delivering on time and take on the risk of, price. At least we have rationally gotten there without just letting the market bid it up. And as Bill Seed used to say, that the best day any owner ever has on design bid build is the day they open the bids. It only gets worse from there.
Yeah, and I think, again, I think we're getting a level of attraction here where, the project managers, the project directors, I think, they're looking for ways in which they can deliver projects differently. I think that's a driving force here. The other driving force is, I think, you get the folks in the procurement shops that, they're now opening their eyes to say, we need more tools. You need to get these tools available to the project managers, the project directors. We can't just kind of give them the same old. And, depending on the jurisdiction that you're working in, I think, that's going to require some policy changes.
I think so too. I think, some of the, just the nature of what we consider the broader public sector in Ontario tends to push us towards making decisions that then absolve you and wash your hands of it, as opposed to creating these partnerships to deal with the issues as they come along, because there are inevitably issues, right?
Right. And I think the consultants and the contractors, you know, that make these teams up, I think they also realize the value proposition for them as well.
Right.
You know, let's face it, you talked about, you know, the light rail transit up there in Ottawa. I mean, that does not make anybody in the industry look good, right?
And it's,
owner, it's, designer, builder, nobody comes off looking good. And I think what it does is just erodes the public trust. And, you know, so why bother making even these large investments in these, you know, these public infrastructure projects? Because the, you know, the distrust gets leveled on everybody.
And then these public, and, you know, like, as you say, these public projects, there's a reason for them, right? There's a value proposition for why we need these things. And the value proposition is not, you know, enriching the designer or the contractor, or, you know, making the city dig deep into their pockets. There's a study out that there's $270 billion worth of infrastructure that's needed in Canada. And I was just thinking the other day that if we could, you know, that $270 billion always turns into $340 billion. But what if we turn that $270 billion into, you take 10% off of that? Right. Suddenly there's, you know, $40 or $50 billion to spend on educating doctors so we're not waiting in emergency rooms. I mean, the ripple effect across the economy and the public service is enormous.
Right.
If we just did these things in a sensible way.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more with you, Dick. And, you know, I get a sense, you know, maybe for the first time in my career, that, you know, we might be on the doorstep of kind of that change in thinking. And that'd be great. It's
I think
very
we
satisfying.
Are. Yeah. So thank you, my friend. This has been terrific. Thanks for taking a little more time than I had promised you. But the story is so good that I wanted to make sure that we captured it all. I really appreciate you taking time for the podcast.
Well, it's always fun talking with you, Dick. Thanks again, eh?
Okay, Mark.
All right, we'll talk soon.
We'll see you down the road. Yep.
Thank you for tuning in to the Lean Construction Blogs podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word by sharing, subscribing, or leaving a review on your preferred podcast listening platform. Remember to join us next time as we continue to lower the barriers to applying lean construction and help take your lean journey to the next level. And don't forget to visit the Lean Construction blog to stay up to date on our latest podcast episodes, weekly blog posts, monthly webinars, and upcoming conferences. We hope to see you on the next episode.